Hello again, Bob Chaundy here with another Considering Art podcast in which I talk to an artist about their work and something of their life. Occasionally on Considering Art, I talk to emerging artists. My guest today only recently graduated in fine art, but she's unusual in that she's in her 60s and with quite a story behind her. Henrietta Sophia Wallace Dunlop describes herself as an impoverished aristocrat. In 2018, she was the subject of a prize-winning documentary entitled Fuck It, It's Over. In it, she decries the gentrification of Soho, that part of London once frequented by the famous and the infamous. It's where Sophia, as she likes to be known, grew up and has fond memories of. Fittingly, her last exhibition of her expressionist paintings was held at L'Escargot restaurant in Soho's Greek Street. Her life, as we'll find out now, has been a difficult one, to put it mildly. Art, she says, is a very therapeutic way of getting through the bullshit, an escapism from a brutal reality. I visited Sophia in her Peabody Housing Association flat in central London, where she's currently writing her autobiography, Broke in Belgravia. Sophia, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Bob.
Now, your name is Henrietta Sophia Wallace Dunlop. That's a lot of names. Is that by any chance related to your aristocratic lineage?
Well, the last two names, Wallace Dunlop, I descend from William Wallace.
And William Wallace of Scotland?
Yes. He's on his mother's side. And the Sophia is my grandmother's middle name. And the Henrietta, well, my father had an affair with Francis Bacon's model, Henrietta Moraes. And I think the idea came from that, but my mother liked it as well. But I don't think my father told her quite how his idea of naming me, basically named me after a shag, basically, you know.
Your artistic connection was already made.
Yes. And the irony is that when I went to Soho after being kicked out of boarding school, I met Francis Bacon. And I was slightly horrified because, you know, I was 15, 16 at the time. And he had boot polish in his hair and he was sort of grunting my direction. And he would have quite long intellectual chats with my father. And my father, being a very good-looking man, obviously, that held quite a lot of interest for Francis. And my father was 6'4". And I was actually frightened. I thought Francis' face was very distorted. And he, you know, I was 16. I'd never met anyone like that.
Well, let's return to Soho later. Yeah. But you were brought up by your grandparents, basically, weren't you?
Well, yes, my parents left me when I was 4. I grew up in sort of Cheval Place, and I'm not exactly sure what happened, but a very nice couple of friends of my father's found me on my own eating beans in the house, and I think my father was probably off with the au pair at that point, but I don't know for sure. And so they took me to my grandparents, and I just stayed with them.
Well, this is because they, were divorcing or something?
Yeah, they were divorcing, and I think my parents were homeless. I mean, my father had some sort of dreamer kind of gambler kind of... He wasn't good at working, and my mother went out to work, and he just did deals, you know. That was the thing about the time that we were in. Was there were a lot of con men and tricksters and people around, you know, like Peter, my father knew the Crays and Peter Rachman, and they used to hang out with the aristocratic people. And my father knew John Aspinall and Lord Lucan, and he used to gamble at the Claremont with them. So, you know, it was a very strange combination. So when I hit Soho, you know, on the one hand, you'd meet the builder and then you'd meet somebody really posh, but they would get on really well. And everybody was drunk most of the time. And so you'd have the long lunch. Lunch would start on a Wednesday and go through the Thursday, Friday, and then there'd be the weekend. So people, in fact, weren't working very much at all. I had a job. I was working in Marshall Cavendish at 15 in the picture library for a woman called Janet Grier. And my father's girlfriend got me the job, and I earned £20 a week.
That sounds like quite a lot in those days.
Well, it was, and my father's flatmates, Jenny, they were both called Jenny, but the flatmate was called Jenny Marshall, got a bit jealous about my salary, so I left my job. It's a regret I have to this day. And I went and worked in Harrods for £14.75 a week, because that was kind of socially acceptable for someone of my age at that time, you know.
Now, you're talking in your teens now, aren't you?
Yeah, I was 15 then, yeah.
But what happened to your schooling?
Well, I was expelled from boarding
school. What for?
Extreme drinking.
Really?
Yes. Well,
how long have you been? Had you been drinking?
Well, about four of us were expelled for drinking 100% proof rum. And my father's party quirk was basically, he would say, "Oh, my daughter's been expelled for drinking 100% proof rum." And he said, "I've been trying to find some for years." So, yeah.
Were you in any way arty as a kid?
Not really, a bit. I mean, my grandmother had an insight on it. She said to me, "I think when you're older, you will become an artist." And I went, "Don't be silly, Granny, I won't be an artist." She said, "Oh, yes, I can see it." I used to make a lot of things for her, you know. And I found them all in, when she got very old, I was really touched. I went to a drawer for something, I found it, them all my things there. So that was nice. Mm.
So you were expelled from school, you turned up in Soho.
I said, "Danny, I'm coming to say I never saw you for 4 years." You know, I would wait by the gate and he would never turn up. And it was very sad, you know. So I said, "Right, I'm coming to stay with you." You know, I was 15, 16, and it was September, I remember. And I landed on his couch and I was just, I wrote an article about it. I met Linda Lovelace in the...
She's
French
the
house.
Porn star from Deep Throat.
Yes.
What was Linda Lovelace like?
Drugged. It was quite sad, actually. Drugged up, yeah. And what struck me is her pink shorts, and she had bruised legs. So, and she was very vulnerable. I mean, I can remember that. Very, very vulnerable. And then she was very shy, very drugged up, and very, very sad, and totally being taken advantage of. As were many women at that time, you know.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, as a teenager in an area that was well known for its vice, drug gangs and everything,
yeah.
Didn't you ever feel frightened?
No. I'll tell you why, because it was a great sense of... It's not like now, I feel more frightened now. It was a great sense of community, you know. People always looked out for one another. Not anymore. And it was very important that they did. I mean, you know, they'd go, "Oh, so-and-so, where is he?" We didn't have mobile phones. People met in the French House, 6 o'clock.
The French House is the well-known pub in Soho.
Yes. And, you know, for me, when my father died, they said, "Oh, it's an end of an era," because he was a huge character. And I painted the painting of the French House with a coffin in front. And I thought, you know, well, that's Daddy's coffin. But at the same time, I thought, it's the death of Soho, because every 500 yards, there's a hotel. And the film that I made, Fuck It, It's Over, is talking about that.
Okay, we'll talk about that in a second. But the French House is well known for the characters that frequented it. You mentioned Francis Bacon. I think Augustus John, another artist, often went in there, didn't he?
Dylan Thomas.
But was he still alive when you were there?
No.
Geoffrey Bernard's another one.
Oh, I knew him. Yeah. Oh, what a misery. He was a rent boy in the '50s. Yeah. But he was a great writer, and my father and he never got on, never liked him. But when he was sort of dying, my father cooked him dinner. And I said, Daddy, why do you do that? You don't get on with him. He said, oh, I just felt very sorry for him, you know.
What about film stars? There were lots around then, weren't there, apart from Linda Lovelace?
I met Rod Steiger. Well, he tried sort of chatted me up in a restaurant. Quite a few hit on me back then, because I was underage, and, you know, they were all trying to grab your virginity, you know. You know, everyone would say, oh, well, I'd go out with you, but I know your father, you know, which is kind of weird to me, you know. Why would I go out with somebody who's like 40 years older than me?
Did anybody look after you?
No, not really. No, I sort of wandered around. I looked after everyone. I did the cleaning. I remember I took my laundry to the Chinese laundrette, and I mentioned in the article that I met a Chinese boy who took me to this den of iniquity, and I was really frightened because it looked like, you know, something out of the Triad kind of thing.
That's sort of like an opium den.
Yeah, yeah, in Gerrard Street. I mean, I went into one of the, you know, gambling sort of weird places along there at that time. You know, there was a big underworld, you know. People don't realise what it was like then. You know, every month a Maltese would bump off somebody, and, you know, there was gangs then, but not like now, just different, you know. They stayed within the community.
What did your father do exactly? How did he get by?
He did as little as possible. My father wasn't keen on working, but he worked on the Harpers and Queen as a writer, and I believe that he wrote stuff for Peter York, the Sloane Ranger. I think he wrote quite a lot of that. And he just did freelance stuff in National House. And he met people like Thea Porter would come get drunk and sort of sleep on the couch during the afternoon, you know.
I don't know her, Thea Porter.
She was like one of the fashion people, editors with one of the magazines. She was quite well known. And there just was a constant stream of people and women, you know, finding various women in my dad's bed while my father's girlfriend was at work, you know.
He sounds like not terribly responsible in terms
not
of...
At
he,
all.
You can kind of understand why he didn't want to bring you up. But what about your mother? Why didn't she take you?
Well, she had to work. You know, someone's got to earn the bacon, you know. She had to work. And, you know, my parents, I love my parents a lot. I mean, hugely. But they were dysfunctional, you know, very dysfunctional.
And what were your grandparents like who did bring you up?
Oh, they were wonderful, yeah. My grandmother was amazing. Well, and my step-grandfather was amazing as well. Just wonderful people. I mean, she had three children with the first husband, who she married when she was 16 and he was 60. She eloped. And he died, I think, in 1937. And he's buried in Dunsfold. That's where I buried my father. And... her family had been quite a rich family, you know, Whitney in America, and her mother had been a bit of a beauty.
Whitney as in Whitney Museum?
Yes, and related to the Vanderbilts. I've never been to America, but I believe he lost all the money in the Wall Street crash of 29.
When you were in Soho and afterwards, did you go to lots of art galleries and that sort of thing?
No, not at all. I went to a lot of drinking. Cider. I can remember lying outside the Fog and Firkin. That wasn't in Soho, that was outside. But every weekend, everything was revolved around alcohol. I mean, I was really drunk when I was 16. And then much later on, a woman came up to me and said, oh, I used to worry about you. I said, well, if you worried about me, why don't you say something or do something? They were playing spoof. You know, they try and pretend to sell you off to somebody for half a crown. They thought it's hilarious, you know. I can remember going to Bieber. I can remember wearing Laura Ashley clothes. And
doubtless going to lots of clubs.
I went to Le Kilt as a sort of escapism, you know. I used to really like going to Le Kilt. My father took me to Louise's, which was a lesbian nightclub, and I was really shocked, you know, women dancing together in Soho, you know.
You made a documentary called Fuck It, It's Over, about the end of an era in Soho. What was the sort of theme of it?
I coined the phrase, oh, fuck it, it's over. Can we save Soho? And I just coined that phrase, and I said no. Because everywhere you were looking, there'd be building work. Everywhere. They're, you know, knocking out basements, building hotels, pulling everything down. I think if you have corporate pricks basically coming in and pulling everything down for financial gain, you lose something. You lose that identity. You know, I knew strippers at the Windmill. They were great, you know. My father, of course, knew all the prostitutes on the corners, because at that time it wasn't gay, it was a lot of prostitutes. Not gay prostitutes, but straight prostitutes. And or not on the street corners. And, you know, we used to go for a lot of takeaways. I can remember being sort of fascinated going to the Li Ho Fook and the way they chop meat really fast. And you'd get a really good meal for nothing, peanuts. I'm a vegetarian now, but I ate meat back then. And I remember one girl saying, you must come up. And she had a flat off Shaftesbury Avenue. And with great glee, she said, someone was murdered there on the street. There's the blood. Look out the window. There's the blood. And I was going, really? You know, why? She said, oh, gangs, Maltese, you know.
But isn't it good that all these gangs, all these murders have gone?
But they haven't. They've grown up. There's 400 stabbings in, you know, a year in one hospital. You know, there's...
Yeah, but that's not in Soho, is it? That's just all over London.
No, we've just got all the homeless in Soho everywhere. See, that's another aspect. You know, I was in a hostel in Soho. I spent 1 year and 4 months. And I was very lucky. I wrote an email, and I was very lucky that Mark Field got my email, and he's ex-British Army. And I said, well, I descend from William Wallace, and I, you know, my family didn't fight for this country for hundreds of years for their descendant to end up on the pavement. And he picked it up, and I got my flat here. I was really lucky. I had a fear of ending up in Birmingham, you know.
Anyway, Sophia, art. You decided to go into art, become an artist. How did that begin?
Well, I was living in Paris for 2 years, and I came back to London. I was walking through Fulham Broadway, and I saw a flyer, and I thought, oh, I'll check it out at Adult College in Chelsea, you know. And well, when I went to check it out, I knew the guy who was the director, and I went, oh, great, I can just do this. And he went, oh, no, you've got to do your A-level, your B-tech, level 3, you've got to do the whole 9 yards. And I went, oh, come off it, can't you just, you know. No, so I said, okay. So I did very sort of bits and pieces there, and I met a very nice man who's a really good teacher called Paul Gilder. And I thank him because he really taught me a lot, you know, very good teacher. Anyway, I started there, and then I finished in Farnham. Basically, I went back then, there was no space to do the last year, so I did the last year in Farnham. And I'd caught a virus in my ear, so I had chronic vertigo. So I was staggering to university in Farnham, looking like some drunk person. I eventually got my degree and graduated last year.
And what sort of themes occupy you when you're painting? I mean, let's take a portrait you've got here of a Moroccan woman called Shavia. What's Shadia. The story? Shadia.
Well, I became friends with her when I was living in France in Montpellier, when I had the wine thing going on. And she was very kind to me, and she said, oh, be careful, you're going to get ripped off, you're too nice, blah, blah, blah. And that, unfortunately, her prophecy came true. And she was a really modern Moroccan, really mature, very mature. And I said, oh, Shadi. And she said, yeah, it's my 30th birthday coming up. And I said, oh, I'd like to do a painting of you. And that's the painting I did of her. Because she never wore a veil. And she saw it and she went, wow. And they hung it in her boyfriend. They had this jazz club together. She was very modern. She was sharing the business. You know, she was very involved with her boyfriend in the business. But then they split up. And he said, the eyes are following me all around the club. Can you look after it? And I lost touch with her, so I've still got the painting. But I intended to give it to her and never saw her again, sadly. She was very cool. But it's supposed to show, you know, that under the veil, there is a sexy woman, you know, who has rights and is free. And that is, you know, how I was brought up. My great aunt Marion was the first hunger striker for the vote. And she did all the parades. And I grew up in her house. Mackie's Hill was her house that my grandmother sort of inherited.
Yeah, social issues, they occupy some of your ideas in art, don't they?
Yeah, social justice, you know. I'm a real, you know, having been homeless myself, it was very shocking, you know, that I had cockroaches and mice and schizophrenics shouting the Bible out of the window every night. You know, no Bibi Stockholm for me, you know. It was...
But have you converted that into art, that experience?
I think so. I think I did, you know, I think something can shape you. You know, I was teaching English for free cappuccinos, you know, in My Place Cafe, which was, they were really kind to me. And I had an art exhibition there, Soho Collective. And I'd love to, you know, open an art house in Soho and get people off the street.
The Hand in Hand is another one of your pictures in which there's a lot of activity music going on. What's behind that?
The Hand in Hand pub is in Brighton. And I moved to Brighton. I thought, you know, well, I can't really afford to be in London at that point. So before I'd been... You know, I've moved 45 times in my life. It's a lot all over Europe. You know, this is the most settled I've been now. Because, you know, apart from when I grew up till I was 15, I'm like a gypsy. I'm always on the move. Mm. So the Hand in Hand was the pub. And I thought, well, you know, I used to go and see jazz on a Sunday there. I thought, oh, that'd be a nice sort of painting to do. It's about, you know, the hands, the music, playing the music. And so I created that painting from that.
After your father died, you painted a picture of a crucifixion called Hanging On to Belief. Was your faith shattered a bit then?
When I went to Brighton, we went there because I've got an amazing flat there, and I thought, oh, it's going to be cheaper to live here. I didn't know anyone. My grandparents had actually been scattered there at some point, and even my great-grandmother. But I didn't know anyone there, so I went to the church, local church there, St. George's, and I became a church member. And I went regularly when my father was dying. You know, he was very, very ill. We kind of fell out at the end, but... You know, it was all very sad. And I started doing piano lessons with the church organist, who actually started to stalk me. So it was really became really difficult. And he actually lay on my father's grave saying he was a waster with a bottle of whiskey. You couldn't believe, you can't make that up, but that actually happened. And after that had happened, I came back up to London, and being stalked, you know, and losing your father and all the circumstances around my father's death, I was sort of pacing around, and I found that my belief was really coming into question. And I painted that because I was struggling. I call it hanging on to belief because I was struggling to believe in things, because everything had been destroyed around me. I mean, my family were fighting me over a Watts painting, And I ended up homeless, you know, after that. So it was a whole load of... It's such a big story, but it'll be in the book.
There's another one you've done called The Potato Farmer.
Well, I initially started doing black and white paintings in acrylic, and because I really love old black and white movies. And The Grapes of Wrath was one of the books at school. And of course, seeing, you know, Henry Fonda playing it, and it's about the Depression. And then I met this guy in the French House who's very good looking, and he was epileptic as well. And I said, I'd like to do a painting of you. Of course I would, you know. And I did. I like that kind of moodiness. And I'm hoping to be doing something like that again soon.
And you did another one around that time of an alcoholic.
Yeah, well, I've met quite a few alcoholics in my time. I don't know. I've been 17 years not drinking, but I always seem to attract alcoholics. The last guy I dated was an actor, and he's an alcoholic, sadly.
What are you working on now?
I just went to Rome in April, and I did This is a Memory of When I Was 23, that one. I just finished that one as well. I was in Trastevere when I was young. I got really drunk, and I took a sort of turn in Trastevere, and I met all these gypsies making a fire on this, near this old bed, and there was, like, music, and it was kind of amazing to me. I mean, it was lovely, and I had that great sort of memory of being slightly destitute in Rome. That's such a long story, it'll be in the book. I missed Rome. I hadn't seen those kind of sights for over 40 years, so I went to Rome in April for 4 days just to look at the sightseeing, Spanish Steps, Trastevere, and I went to the Vatican. I went to see this particular painting called The Deposition of Christ by Caravaggio, who is my favourite artist, probably. I like Goya, I like Munch, and I like Van Gogh. But Caravaggio, I did my dissertation on Caravaggio, and such an amazing artist of chiaroscuro, which is light and dark. And a sort of fascination came from when I spent 6 months at Birkbeck doing art history before I switched my degree. There was so much work, I was so depressed. I just thought, nah, I can't cope with this. And so I switched my degree to just fine art. But it's always writing, you know, there's not a lot of painting. All I want to do is paint. Anyway, when I came back from Rome and having this incredible experience in the Vatican of seeing Michelangelo and Rubens and, you know, San Sebastian. And I think that all the sadnesses and all the difficult parts of my life have come into a lot of my work. I mean, I do tend to use a bit too much black in my paintings. And I've been really supported by Lescargot. You can still go and see some of my art in Lescargot, and Brian Cleavis, you know, and my friend Naomi have been incredibly supportive to me. And it was at that point that I had my accident, fell and broke both my arms, and I spent nearly 3 months in bed recently, so I'm still recovering from it. The thought of not being able to paint was just terrible. And I went through a big depression, you know, because I thought, oh, I might not be able to paint. But I am. I'm back on the road. I'm doing this. But it is tough.
Sophia, thanks so much for talking about your absolutely extraordinary life.
Thank you, Bob.
Henrietta Sophia Wallace Dunlop. She's right. You couldn't make it up. That's it from me, Bob Chaundy, for 2023. Enjoy the festivities and join me again in the new year.